Welcome, everyone, to Canine Top Tales. I am your host, Sonia Nordstrom, a retired special agent of the FBI and a 27-year handler of search and rescue recovery canines. My guest today is someone whose life's mission can be summed up in just one word: service. Service both in the military and in her civilian life. Her military career started in 1983 when she enlisted in the U.S. Army Reserve. She received her officer's commission in 1988, and in 1999, she joined the California Army National Guard as a Medical Service Corps officer. With deployments to Kosovo in 2006 and to Kandahar in 2018, she rounded out her military career as a full bird colonel with too many awards and decorations to enumerate, culminating most recently with the Legion of Merit Award. In her civilian life, she served as an ER, trauma, ICU, and psychiatric care nurse in Los Angeles before becoming a coroner investigator for the County of Los Angeles, serving a population of more than 10 million. During her 15 years there, she was the Special Ops Team Leader and Department Emergency Coordinator, working extensively in disaster and emergency planning and services for fatality management for the County of Los Angeles. Most importantly for all of us, she initiated a human remains detection canine program for the Los Angeles County Coroner's Office. I am so happy to introduce to you my good friend and canine colleague, retired Colonel Annette Renee Grandpre. Renee, welcome to Canine Top Tales. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Sonia, it's so great to talk to you, as always, and I really appreciate this opportunity.
We go back quite a long ways and have had a lot of fun little capers together, but maybe you can start by sort of giving us your background, you know, professional background.
Well, I became a trauma nurse in 1992 from LAC USC, the county hospital there in Los Angeles. And I worked there for about 10 years. And then on that same campus, there were a lot of the doctors in the ER that would do rotations down at the coroner's office because it was right next door to us on the county campus there. And so I became interested in some of the coroner operations through a doctor there, and she encouraged me to look at becoming a coroner investigator. And so I did that. So I spent almost 10 years at the hospital as a trauma nurse, and then another 15 years at the coroner's office after that.
And at the same time, you had a military career.
Yes. So I joined the military in 1983 as an enlisted soldier and was just so fortunate to, I went into the recruiter and told him I wanted to be an airborne soldier because that's what my father had been, airborne infantry. And luckily there was a unit in Maryland that was a reserve special forces unit. And after I talked to him, I went straight on from basic training to AIT to airborne school, and then spent two years in this Special Forces Reserve unit up in Maryland that was fantastic. All we did was jump. Which is pretty fun, and I met a lot of great guys. And there I met my first sergeant, who had been a special forces medic in Vietnam. And he was now, as a civilian PA, or at that time, a civilian PA, and one of the first PAs that existed, the Physician's Assistance Program. And he encouraged me to go back to school. And so I eventually did, and I moved to California and finally finished my degree in nursing, and simultaneously did ROTC there and became an officer. And then, some ups and downs, or ins and outs as life went by, but I became a nurse, and I eventually became a Medical Service Corps officer in the California Army National Guard, and I retired from there in 2018 after a final deployment to Afghanistan. So,
as a colonel, no less, right? Full bird colonel.
Yeah. Yes.
You're a slacker. You're definitely a slacker. So, when you went to the coroner's office, can you give some perspective? I think most of us envision the pretty stainless steel drawers and doing identifications from television. Can you give a little perspective of what the LA County Coroner's Office looks like and the volume and the size?
Well, the volume is hard for most people to imagine. And even when I first went there, which was 1999, 2000, was the old crypts that we had were designed to hold, I think, about 500 decedents. And at the time, in the 90s, early 90s, there was a significant gang war in LA, and the number, LA County, a lot of people are surprised about the size of it. It's 4,000 square miles. It encompasses like 52 cities. Some of these stats are a little bit old, but almost 10 million people and one coroner's office for that whole county. And so we were frequently over, we had too many decedents for the number of crypts that we had. And a lot of that was that people had a difficult time sometimes picking up their loved ones. They couldn't afford it, or they were VA folks. And so a lot of things changed in the 2000s, and they made their processes more efficient and started clearing it out a little bit. But in the beginning, when I first went there, it was almost like a noir film, you know, we had Polaroid cameras as investigators. We wrapped the bodies ourselves. We had one person to help us transport them. They went into a very overcrowded crypt, and there weren't a lot of things that were done very efficiently because it hadn't been set up like that. It hadn't been set up for the volume that it had, even when I first went there. And a lot of things changed from, there's some really historic people that were there. Thomas Noguchi, the quote unquote coroner to the stars, he did a lot of amazing things. In particular, in emergency management early on. And then Dr. Lakshmanan Sathavagaswaran, he was the medical examiner the whole time that I worked there, he was the medical examiner. And he also did some pretty amazing things to help help modernize the facility, the forensics there. We had criminalists. We had a very high functioning lab, or a lab that really did a lot of work on toxicology, some on DNA. DNA was like in its infancy in some ways. And most of that got done at the sheriff's or LAPD or whatever agency we were working for, but I think they modernized quite a bit later on. And so, you know, it's just an interesting setup. It's different. LA County coroner is a lot different than many other coroner/medical examiner systems. It's kind of a blended system. So we had a medical examiner who was the chief or the head of the department, but then we also had a chief of who was a coroner investigator. The 2000s was really an exciting time for forensics, and there were a lot of things that were being experimented with, and there was one particular technician, Jose, who specialized in rehydrating mummified fingers so that we could get fingerprints from them. So identification was very difficult. We had fingerprints, but there was no, there wasn't very much DNA. There was no facial recognition. We did a lot of identification through, you know, trying to compare to an old photograph. And so it was just a new and exciting time for forensics and toxicology, criminology. A lot of people were discovering things in the 2000s that are now part of everyday work, but at the time were different than the old, you know, 40s and 50s kind of noir, like I said, noir. And forensics looked like.
What was sort of your typical day? Because I think, again, the volume is hard to fathom, right? It's just...
Right. Yeah. And I'm trying to think of the numbers that we had of investigators on. At any given time, we didn't have very many investigators. And for a county of 10 million people, and even though our... So the coroner mission, if I can recall this exactly, is that it was really, we were to investigate all unnatural deaths. That being said, probably the majority of cases that we had every day, every week, every month were really in reality natural deaths, but they were unattended somehow. So there was no doctor around, there was no witness. But we did have all the other deaths that happened, accidents, suicides, homicides, undetermined deaths that happened that were unnatural. So we had a pretty robust caseload for any investigator. Would probably do two or three cases during the day, and a lot of that was determined by, well, it was definitely by what came in, but if I worked for a short time as a lieutenant as well, there doing dispatching to the cases, but you had to consider if the investigator was going to be going to Lancaster or all the way down to San Pedro, and you couldn't have the same person. I mean, that's, are you sending them to West LA in the middle of the day? So there were some really interesting things about Los Angeles that
For anybody that's not familiar with traffic situations in Los Angeles, it would take me in the morning to go from, you know, Antelope Valley down to Westwood. I'd have to allow 2.5 hours on certain days. Yeah. And it would take, so the idea that you can bop back and forth is just really not possible. It's not easy going, and I'm sure it's even worse today than it was then. So
there's a lot to consider when you're talking about picking up a body. And I think TV doesn't really do it justice when they just sort of
it looks very clean and simple. Very, very matter of fact, clean and simple.
Yeah, there's a lot to it. So protection of the decedent's property, inventory of the property, inventory of the clothing. You know, a homicide victim, their clothing can contain evidence of the suspect. And so you need to be able to make sure that that's processed correctly. And some of those cases, we didn't have all those considerations early on. We started to learn more and more, I think we as in me, but I think also just
as
law
an industry.
Enforcement.
Yeah.
Yeah. Realize the need for doing that. And something as simple, like we were always responsible for recovering scrapings underneath victims' fingernails. And so that would go into, we did hair samples and fingernail scrapings. And those would just go into paper envelopes and be registered with the case. Well, years later, when we started doing more DNA, those things became discoverable or became part of what helped solve certain cases by being able to analyze the DNA that were under those fingerprints, fingernail scrapings, not just blood type, but things like that. So
yeah, it's amazing that it was collected before people really knew exactly what could be done with it. So that's pretty amazing, and that it survived, meaning that the scrapings that you would take years before they're really usable survived the test of time, right? To be able to identify. I think if I remember correctly, and I may be wrong, but I think you and I met probably up in the Angeles National Forest when an ulna had been found randomly in the woods, and we were on a dog search trying to find where that bone came from. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, there were many, many things that coroner investigators were involved in, and everyone had a little bit of their own specialty in some ways. But one of the things I got interested in early on was the special operations team. And our special operations team was primarily also called the skeletal recovery team. And so when people would find bones, we had access to a forensic anthropologist and her students, and we would get the needed professionals together to see if we could go out and search and see if we can recover the rest of the skeleton and figure out what happened. And a lot of those could be, you know, someone goes into a remote place, they commit suicide, they hang themselves, they eventually become skeletonized, and then those bones get spread out. And so once someone recovers that, I mean, there's a lot of benefit to recovering the whole body, finding out who that person was, and hopefully bringing closure to a family who otherwise had no idea what happened to their person, their loved one, their father, mother, brother. I kind of became fascinated with it. It was really an interesting pursuit, and it was very rewarding to try to find the source of like where that one ulna came from. Could we track that back to where the body originally decomposed? And so, that's how we met. And
that's how you started the program, right?
Well, I mean, it was a multi-step thing. I mean, we ended up, it's because of the size of LA County, I think, is that we really were requested to do a lot of cases like that. Frequently, the forensic anthropologist would say, hey, we can go and do a search. We can do like put 10 people in a line and try and search the entire Antelope Valley desert, or we can help narrow it down with a canine. And I was all in on that. I'm like, oh, great, a canine, you know? And that's how we met. And your expertise and just leadership in that was phenomenal. And all of us learned something during every search. And I thought, well, it's great to have Sonia and one dog and two or three dogs if we had your training group come, or other cadaver dogs that were trained through search and rescue come. That was, you know, that was great. More the merrier, and the, you know, the less work as we split it up. But the more we did that, it seemed to me that it would be so much more efficient. And I always have like, look at the big brain on Renee, you know, I'm gonna come up with some better idea. And I developed this idea of having a canine at the coroner's office that we could narrow down some of these cases initially, you know, just to start. Is this really, a case that we need to pull out more resources? Do we need to have giant searches? Do we need to have four or five dogs? Do we need to have 50 people out searching the desert, you know, or the woods?
I mean, there were dog teams going out for years that were helping the coroner's office, but I think when you got more involved in the SORT team, you thought, why don't we have our own resource? And you at the time had been writing grants for other things. So you were familiar with the grant writing process.
Oh my God, I forgot all about that part. Yes, I was writing grants for the weapons of mass destruction team, which also was the, you know, sort of the flavor of the day at that time for grants and emergency management. But the idea, the more I learned about how you trained and what the dogs were capable of, and then along with that, learning the variation in what dogs came out, what dogs were available, was this a volunteer dog? And so all those things that that are really relevant to law enforcement much more than search and rescue, like being able to testify in court, certification. Well, certifications I think are important in search and rescue, but there were certain forensic things that were relevant to criminal investigations that weren't so much the missing Alzheimer's patient.
Exactly. So in California, and of course, everything evolved through the years, but at that time, the California Office of Emergency Services Cadaver Dog Standard was just kind of being developed and started to be used. It was really almost exclusively volunteer. In the LA area, I was the only law enforcement person who was doing it as a volunteer, as well as sort of on duty when it was a criminal matter. So I think that's probably how you and I got talking about it. And because you were writing grants, the recommendation was, hey, if you want to do this right, go and get a quality detector dog, go and get the appropriate training versus sort of, I'm starting a puppy and I'm going to spend every weekend with the volunteer group. And, and you had the means and the opportunity to do that through the coroner's office if you made it an official capacity. So certainly with such a large coroner's office, it made sense to have this resource as one of the specialized resources available. And not every case needs a whole team of people. And you still had the liaison to the volunteers to reach out to.
It just became more and more apparent that if we could have our own resource, it's not something that all those 52 agencies, all those smaller agencies that I'm talking about, they may need one per 5 years, but we would need them once a week, once a month, because we did the whole county. And so it wasn't financially feasible for those smaller agencies to do it, but it was financially feasible for us if we had an investigator who was going to deploy anyway. If it was that same investigator was trained as a canine handler and could do a lot more of the search just in the initial investigation, that would have been much more cost efficient. And so my original idea was that I would write that grant, and all I needed was a canine handler at the coroner's office, and no one could do it. No one wanted to do it. And I was a dog neophyte. I never had a dog personally. I didn't know much about, I love animals. That was probably my biggest criteria at the time. I'm like, well, but I happen to have a house that could do it, a yard, and I kept coming up with ways to do transport for them, and then the training to get the grant to do the initial training. And I sold it to my bosses, and thank goodness they were open to even pursuing it. The chief at the time and then Dr. Lakshmanan, they were like, okay, well, give it a shot.
And into the scene comes Indiana Bones. Tell us about Indy. Tell us about
Indy. Oh my God. So on your recommendation, thank thankfully, I went to probably the best, one of the best training kennels in the world, and I ended up at Von Lick Kennels. Oh God, what, like 2004 on a, on one of their initial very beginner trainer or beginner handler courses up there in Indiana. And one day we were all standing out in the, in a group in the front, and all of a sudden this little wiry little German Shepherd, cute as cute can be, came running in and out of my legs and jumping around like she was chasing butterflies. And she, I fell in love with her instantly. And I'm like, well, where did this dog come from? And she was very young. And I think Kenny was hesitant. He didn't want to pair me with a younger dog since I was a young handler, well, a new handler. But, you know, love is love. So, and she had so much drive. Like I never, if you've never had a canine, a dog that is bred for drive, you can't even imagine the difference between that and a, you know, a pet of any sort that that wasn't. And so she was super intense, and she did fantastic. And I learned as much as I could while we were still there. And then was fortunate to be able to come back and train with you guys in your little training group. A couple times a week, I would train with her, either with you or on my own. And then I got to go to Adlerhorst to train. So I had a lot of benefits in helping train her, and day in, day out. Got a truck. I redid a truck that was in the corner vehicle inventory so that I could transport her in the back with a kennel. And so I started taking her on all my cases, and that way I could train her, you know, on cases that were appropriate after I would do the investigation, if I could still run her afterwards, depending on whole situation with the decedent, that I could take the that advantage. We would get training aids from post-autopsy, the basically remnants of autopsy, and be able to make training aids. And it was, we just started learning and started growing. And
in my experience, dogs are either supposed to be magical or they're worthless. So that tends to be kind of the, like, why can't they create the body out of thin air? Or dogs can't find anything. And of course, both is kind of true. So do you remember any sort of kind of your first really cool one where you're like, wow, this really made a difference? You know what I mean? This dog really made the difference, or any of those kind of stories that you can tell?
One particular case that was a homicide, the body was in pieces, that was really interesting, was we were on a slope. I think it was in Hollywood Hills, and we were on a slope, and Indy alerted on a particular spot, and it was pretty much a dead giveaway. You could see that it was something had been buried there. And it was small, it was only like 6x6 spot. And, but she alerted there, I think whatever forensics team came in, it wasn't our team at first, it wasn't a coroner team that came and recovered the part, the body part, it was a different agency. And they recovered a body part. And I was like, wow, that was a great hit. Well, then I kept searching her on this hillside. I kept continuing the search on the hillside. She kept going back to that spot. And I don't know if you were there, if you recall this.
I don't think I was, no.
She kept going back to that spot. And I'm like, yeah, good girl. You know, you got it. You got it there. And then one of our criminalists came by and was looking at it and put a probe in. Well, whoever had collected it in the first place one of the, our anthropologists and our criminalists were trained to go to undisturbed soil. But this was like one of those, well, we got it. It was right there. We got that body part. There was another body part under there. And Indy kept going back there. And I was so proud of her that, well, I was also proud of myself that I didn't say, no, don't do that.
Get on, move it, move it.
But yeah, he had buried it in a horizontal, you know, two pieces in the same hole, which was really interesting. But it was exciting. There were a lot more kind of mundane cases where we would search and look for things and rule them out than there were dramatic finds.
I think that's another really good point to make, is that so much, the vast majority of searches by cadaver dogs, assuming we're not missing, is to eliminate so that the investigation moves forward. And I've actually done a couple of those this summer, and I document them pretty extensively so that if this becomes a cold case 10 years from now, somebody can say, you know what, that was done at the time and it was done pretty well. And I think we can move forward, because so many of these cases do become cold cases when you can't find someone. And doesn't mean that the conditions weren't such that you'd, I'm not saying that dogs never miss, but it's certainly helpful, because I hate going somewhere and having somebody say, oh yeah, that was done. And I'm like, well, how much was done? You know, what was done?
Right.
Who did it? So I think so much of what cadaver dogs do is sort of an efficient, relatively non-disturbing methodology to sort of clear or to narrow. But at the same time, if you're asked, I mean, clearly somebody is on the planet, and then they might be in the right country, and then they might be in the right county. And so the larger the area, the more likely you are, the less probability you have of, you know, the stars aligning to find it. So clearly the more narrow the area, the more detailed the scope of the search. But I think I've feeling good about a clear, it's actually almost the most difficult search I think we do, because you always leave saying, I could have done more, I should have done more, did I miss this, did I miss that?
Right.
So it's always nice when you get that confirmation that yes, the body was found 5 miles from where you searched, so you did not miss it.
Yeah.
So that's always a good thing.
Well, one of the other reasons that I could sell it to the chief was that when we would have a good amount of evidence to try to dig in a certain place, you know, like let's try to uncover this. It supposedly got covered with cement. And I remember purchasing through the grants a cement saw so that we could cut through cement, but it was my team, our team, me included, that would do the digging. And so, you know, if you're doing 2, 3, 4 hours of digging for naught, you know, because that was the only way we could confirm it. It was one more way as we dug, you know, we would run the dog, we would run Indy, and she, and if she didn't alert, it just gave us a higher sense of probability that we could stop at a certain point, and we would still do probing and test pits and all kinds of things. But there's a lot more to it than just the dog magically indicating on a spot and you dig it up and it's a perfectly shaped grave dug by someone.
Not often.
In the desert.
Not often. Yeah, not often. Not if that's the Hollywood grave is what I like to call it, the 3x6. It's kind of, well, another thing that I always kind of feel is, look, if there's some sort of disturbance in a yard, you run the dog over it, the dog says there's nothing, then maybe you can be a little bit more aggressive in the way that you exhume that or excavate that area, right? But if the dog says, oh, there's something here, then you're going to do that inch by inch, trowel to, you know, to not sift everything. So the process, can you just describe a little bit of the process of exhuming human remains from a clandestine grave?
Well, it's very much an like an archaeological dig. So we did a case in a backyard. I'm trying to recall all the circumstances. But there was bloody clothing in the trash can. It was the husband was a suspect. The wife was missing. I took Indy out with the police detectives into the backyard. There was a pretty clear, you know, where something had been disturbed in the backyard, the ground had been disturbed. She went over and hit on it like, boom, that it was a no-brainer. But, and like I said, it was disturbed soil, but then we were like, okay, this is a good, we think that the decedent is here. And so we called out the team. And it starts with like raking and sifting. It's a whole long process to go through each piece of dirt because you're not just looking for a whole body, you're looking for evidence and body parts or teeth or anything that might be in there. And so you kind of rake it, you sweep, every bit of soil that's removed is put through a strainer. You do sweeping and little small trowel bits, and you work the outside of the disturbed earth so you can see where the undisturbed earth is, so you can see the dimensions of the grave. And it's important to maintain those so that you can potentially see what type of instrument or tool made those marks, what was it dug with. So you're just doing this really slow, methodical scraping, sweeping, probing, sifting, and you just keep working your way down until you figure out where the body is. And then it's methodical, taking photographs, removing evidence, clothing, et cetera, to eventually able to remove the body and then do the final part of making sure you know the whole dimensions of the grave and all that final stuff, which is so important. Like I said, the one that they didn't get to undisturbed soil, there was still something there. So sometimes you can find, if somebody shoots someone in a grave, you could recover a bullet potentially that was still in, you know, in the deepest layer. So it's a very intensive, time intensive, resource intensive process, and you have to mark everything in order to mark the evidence. The dog helps get us there, but then there's a lot of work that goes into it after that. So we did do a surprisingly large number of cases where there was like Santeria or evidence of ritual of some sort. And so we were constantly kind of working through that whole process. Was this just somebody having some kind of, you know, drug-induced ritual or a real, different cultures have different methods of burying people or just putting to rest people. And so there were things that would sometimes look very suspicious that turned out to be wax or, you know, or it might be a skull in there, but it was not of forensic value, you know, something that came from a medical specimen kind of thing. Sometimes it wasn't about the big hits, it was about the process that we went through in order to determine if it was a case that we should continue to put resources into or to stop investigating it at that point.
The dog is a tool. Mm-hmm. Google is at times completely valuable, and there wouldn't be success without it. And at other times, it's just a tool of the many tools that maybe work or don't work. Not for lack of trying, not for lack of training, not for lack of calibration, but just the circumstances weren't conducive to the odor being available to the dog, or for whatever reason, it just, you know, the stars didn't align. And I often use an analogy that if you think you're going to get value out of a flashlight at high noon outdoors, not all that valuable, right? So the same kind of goes for dogs and odor. You know, there are circumstances under which it will not be as effective as it could be if the circumstances were different. I remember having a search where when it was over 100 degrees in the afternoon, I was getting weird stuff, and I managed to convince an entire team of people to go back at 6 a.m. when it was in the 50s, and we actually recovered 2 bodies in the desert. So it does, because the scent had laid down and things were not as tumultuous, and the dog was able to localize it better because of what was going on in the atmosphere. And that's bodies that have been in the ground for 10 months, and it still made a difference, which is almost weird when you think about it.
I think, you know, human remains are so extraordinarily difficult to, there's predict. Not one set. Yes. And where they're buried and the environment, I mean, the number of factors that go into a canine being able to pick up an odor are exponential. You know, it's just the length of time that they're there, whether or not they're wrapped, how deep are they buried, what's the humidity, the temperature, there are so many things that go into it that the team, you know, the dog, I used to say that I was just Indy's driver, you know, all I did was drive her to one place or another, but being able to read her behavior developed over time and to see if she was really alerting to something, or was she interested in something? Is this something that I should check out more? I mean, it's a dance. It's not, they are tools, but it's not the same as using a drill. You know, there's much more nuance to it. For human remains, the array of decomposition and the effects the variability of the effects that the environment and the method of death and all the person themselves, their body composition to begin with. I mean, all those things really play into whether or not the canine can alert at a certain spot.
Yeah, it's pretty overwhelming. And at some level, we really, even you who worked amongst it, saw many cases a day, still cannot really train for that specific set of circumstances. It's kind of always a guess, right? So you just keep putting that odor in front of the dog and hoping that they do the right thing.
Well, I had never had a dog before that, so I didn't know exactly what to expect, but she wasn't Rin Tin Tin, you know, she was like she just was going to follow me into the fire, but she was so driven. And so I followed her, honestly. I mean, I wish that I had known more when I had her, because she was such an amazing dog. But I recall one of the best stories where we were, I was very nervous to take her places initially, because I just was learning to be a dog handler, and I didn't always know how she was going to respond and how I should respond. But I recall the time that you and I flew to Tennessee to do training at the body farm. Oh my God. And we both were on the same flight. And so the first time that I'd ever been on an airplane with a dog, let alone a canine, but you went down the aisle first with Drago in front of you. Like, I swear, every person sitting in the seats thought a true life dragon was walking down the aisle. And he was amazing. And he, you guys found your seat, and Indy and I were at the very end of the plane. And so she was like, too, you know, she was in front of me because you had to be in that narrow space. So she was pulling on the leash. She's like, ha, 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 walking down the aisle. And we finally settled into our seat, and she immediately kind of curled up underneath my feet. It was perfect because she wasn't that big. And at some point, a woman came and sat down next to me, and we took off, and Indy was an angel. She was fine down there. And but the woman became curious, and she's like, oh, what does your dog do? I assume he's a canine. She didn't know what I said, yes. On the trip, sorry, I missed the bit, because we had these two just raging canines going down the aisle, but we passed in first class, if you recall this.
Sitting on a seat.
Lassie.
In first class was Lassie, and Naomi Judd was in first class as well.
Lassie, the canine, who was I hadn't been close to a collie in a very long time, but I couldn't believe that it even had a brain in there. Its nose was so narrow, but it was beautiful. It was just sitting pristinely in a first class seat on the seat, and looked with disdain at Drago and Indy as we roared past. And so I'm sitting back next to this woman. She's like, well, what does your dog do? And I said, well, you saw Lassie up there. I said, Indy goes to work when Lassie can't quite communicate that Timmy fell down the well. And I don't know if she understood what I was saying. She didn't even laugh, but I thought it was very funny. That's my one regret, is that I wish I had a little bit more fun with Indy, but she was so driven that she didn't do, you know, I mean, playing for her was like ripping the tennis ball out of your hand. Yeah. There's so much to learn. It's so complicated in some ways, but also so simple in other ways. It's, if you can just go out and have fun, dogs respond to that. That's very rewarding. And if, you know, I sometimes think about getting back into cadaver. It was something that I was I did a lot of research on, and I just don't know where we're going to end up now, but at some point I would love to share my knowledge if I can. And like I said, it's a complicated thing. There's no easy answers.
Yeah. I sort of remember when you first started, you're like, yeah, this is going to be great. And then like a year or two into it, you're like, I did not think this would be quite so difficult.
I was so naive. I remember that. I was like, look, I'm going to have a dog at the coroner's office. We can train every day. She's going to be spot on. She's going to be well qualified. Not, you know, like she's going to have high drive. She's going to be like the
magic
Beethoven of cadaver dogs. And and then as the longer we did it and the more we got into it, the more and more that I realized that how naive I was, but just how, like I said, extraordinarily complicated human remains are. And I've shown you some pictures of some of the decedents that I had that were the same body in like four states of decomposition, you know.
Yeah, there's one that I took from you, and it is so telling, because the question is always, how decomposed is the person we're looking for? What will be the condition of the body? And
right.
There was a body that you guys pulled out of a barrel, out of a pond,
mm-hmm.
and on the same hand that was completely intact, each finger looks like it's from a different person, because it's at a different form of decomposition or state of decomposition. So it's kind of anybody's guess, right? And that's why there's still a lot of people doing research and a lot of people different in the desert, different in altitude, different in the snow, different in the east, different in the soil. So it will forever challenge us, I guess, huh?
Oh, definitely. And there will always be people who will try to cover up their crimes, or people who are lost, you know, or just go out and end up decomposing because of suicide or accident, and that we're just trying to find closure for their families and you know, some sort of answer to the casual hiker that comes across a femur in Griffith Park, you know, where did this come from, and can we figure it out?
I think you're offering yourself up as a resource, as a great resource for anybody that might want to pursue this for their department. So I thank you for that.
Absolutely.
And I thank you for your time. And it's been lovely chatting.
Thank you so much, Sonia. It's always great talking to you.
Well, everyone, that's a wrap for another episode of Canine Top Tales. Please, if you enjoyed it, leave us a kind review and come back for more. Thank you.